It's Central Time. I'm John Munson in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, American architect Frank Lloyd Wright was not really a huge fan of New York City, but the city was foundational to Wright's meteoric rise. We'll talk to an architect and historian to learn more. First, though, we don't really consider moments like eating breakfast or doing yard work to be prime opportunities to capture photographs, but there might be more value in taking photos of these ordinary moments than we realize. When you think about some of your favorite photos from when you were young, or maybe family members, are they posed family portraits or are they candid action shots? We asked that question on the Ideas Network Facebook page and heard from a number of you, including Pamela, who says she shared a photo of her mother at a family reunion in 2012 sipping a drink through a straw. Pamela writes, she swore there was no booze in her daiquiri. Okay. The spunky look on her mom's face says it all. We'll be sharing more of those comments on the Ideas Network Facebook page and asking you to call in with your thoughts. But first, let's welcome our guest. Deanna Dykeman is an artist and photographer based in Kansas City, Missouri. She's photographed family members for decades in her Relative Moments series, and her Leaving and Waving series featuring her parents was just featured in The New Yorker. Deanna, thanks for joining us.
Hello, you're welcome.
Well, we put a lot of thought into taking family photos, gathering everyone at Christmas for that one good shot, and those are nice, but over the years, have you gotten the feeling that some of these smaller, seemingly uninteresting things are actually what we wish we'd documented?
Oh, I think so, yes, definitely. Because those are the things that we start talking about and remembering.
Your series, Leaving and Waving, just got a feature in The New Yorker. Tell us about that. On the surface, it seems like a fairly mundane subject, but when you look at the photos together, it's really quite moving. How did you come up with the idea to do the surveys?
You know, I didn't come up with an idea. I took that first picture. I was leaving. The house was red. The sky was blue. The grass was green. My mom had a pink blouse on and bright blue shorts. I had Kodachrome in my camera. And it just hit me. Take a picture, Deanna. And I was feeling sad because I was leaving. And so I thought, wow, I've got a picture of them in my camera now. And then I started doing it a little more often. And finally, I discovered I had a series. So I didn't plan to do it.
Well, a lot of the value in this series comes with the repeat shots, taking that shot, the same thing happening over time. I think sometimes we just take a photo of something and call it done. What's so special about taking multiple photos of the same thing like that?
Well, you know, I almost did take a few shots and call it done because I was kind of taking these pictures of my parents as they went around their life, and I thought, well, I have enough of those pictures. But then something just kept going because I kept feeling sad when I left, and these were my way of dealing with my sadness. So it was really kind of internally motivated.
So taking photos, is taking photos for you sort of a way to document your story, a visual diary? What value do these photos have for you?
Oh, well, they're treasures for me because they're my family. But what I've found is that other people look at them and they kind of become a conduit for their memories. So in some crazy way, my pictures of my family have allowed other people to think about their own families and their own grandparents and parents.
You have another photo series that I think it's ongoing that you've been doing since the 80s called Relative Moments. You have pictures of family members grilling outside, doing yard work, basic stuff. How did that get started, and what are you trying to capture with it?
Well, that's a good question, John. I was living in Kansas City, and we moved to Louisiana. And I'd grown up in Iowa. All these pictures are in Iowa, by the way, Sioux City, Iowa, the northwest corner of Iowa. And so I'd grown up in the Midwest. I'd lived in the Midwest, went to college in the Midwest, and then I found myself in Louisiana. And I was in the process of discovering how Midwestern I was. And what had been ordinary and commonplace and kind of I couldn't see, all of a sudden I began to see that Midwest, when I came back for visits, the Midwest looked fresh and interesting. And I thought, oh my gosh, I can take some pictures here because I've got something to say about this place. I've grown up here my whole life. I am Midwestern. And that's kind of what started me.
What does a photo do for you when you look at it?
Ooh. Well, you look at a picture and you first look at the subject matter and whatever it's going on in there. And for me, with my parents, it might trigger a memory. But then you kind of get a mood, and it's something goes a little deeper, and you access maybe an emotion or a feeling. So I always feel like there's a couple of layers in a photograph, a good photograph.
So how much do photos help us remember the people or the moments in them? I mean, we can write to each other. We can keep diaries. What's so special about photos?
Well, diaries are pretty amazing, too. And if we can preserve them, you know, sound recordings or videos. But a photograph is really simply pretty timeless. It just sits there. And, you know, that old adage, a picture's worth a thousand words. Well, you know, I was looking at a picture of my dad's face on the screen, and his eyes just went right up through me, and it was 13 years ago, but it almost felt like it was yesterday, and it brought him right back into my life.
Deanna Dankman is an artist and photographer based in Kansas City, Missouri. She's photographed family members for decades in her Relative Moments series. This feels like another one of those things we should consider doing before it's too late. There's some sense of urgency. I mean, our time here is temporary. Maybe we feel that or urgency in our situation now more than usual. What about that that element of trying to capture something before it's too late?
Oh, John, you're so right. After the pictures appeared in The New Yorker, I got a lot of messages on Instagram and Facebook. And one man wrote to me, and he said, you are so right. You know, my dad just died of complications from COVID-19, and I realize I don't have any recent pictures of him and me together. Mm-hmm. You know, wow, that just says it all. And he said it, I didn't.
My mother hated having her picture taken, and so I have very few pictures of her at any age. Most of the family pictures we have feature my father and I. Mom's in a few of them, but she made us pay for it later. Some people just don't like having the camera pointed at them. But now, you know, everybody's got a camera in their pocket. If you look at social media, we're inundated with photographs of just about everything. How has technology changed the way we approach the idea of capturing images?
Well, you can almost be a little sneakier because you could be looking at your screen or you could be taking a picture and they might not know. But, you know, you do have a pretty ephemeral recording there. If you don't save it somehow or print it out or make some provision to put it in an album, you might not have it a few years from now. It could just fly into the ether.
Yeah, what an interesting conversation this is, especially to me, because I'm the worst person in the world at capturing people in photographs. My pictures are all buildings and monuments and mountains and things like that. We're talking with Midwestern photographer Deanna Dankman about photographing friends and family members. She's photographed family members for decades in her Relative Moments series, and her Leaving and Waving series featuring her parents was just featured in The New Yorker. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's the value in taking and looking at photos for you, whether these are printed or just on your phone? What are some of your favorite photographs of your loved ones? Are they candid? Are they posed? Give us a call at 800-642. That's 800-642-1234. Or just post them on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up our conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Deanna Dankman, photographer based in Kansas City, Missouri. She's photographed family members for decades in her Relative Moments series, and her Leaving and Waving series featuring her parents was just featured in The New Yorker. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Tell us about some of your favorite family photos. Does looking at photos help you keep memories of your loved ones close? What do you think? Do we need to take more photos of loved ones in these ordinary moments? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Or you can post your photos and thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. By the way, speaking of that Facebook page, we asked about your favorite family photos. Still time to share there. Here's some samples of the people that we heard from. Another person named Pamela shared a picture of her dad, who passed away in September, taking her daughters on a cruise behind the tractor soon after one of them had cut her own bangs, she says. What a wonderful moment. Paul and Lori shared a photo of their middle daughter's first day of kindergarten, reluctantly walking with her special neighbor for his first day of senior year. Bill says his favorite photos are the ones that capture a moment that you can stage 30-some years later. He posted a photo with that shows him and a few of what I'm assuming are siblings recreating a childhood photo as adults. Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. Deanna, those pictures are some great examples, I think, of what you were talking about earlier, just capturing those special moments that are just they're just happening, and you're lucky to get those shots to be ready to take a photo of them. And what great memories do they provide for us?
Oh, yes. You know, you said something earlier about your mom didn't like to have her picture taken. And I do have one thought. If you do it enough, she'll finally quit complaining. That's what my mom did, anyway.
Well, it's too late now, but it was just easier. If mom doesn't want her picture taken, I pointed the camera elsewhere.
I understand.
Yeah, you know, otherwise, no dill pickles for me. we put a lot of thought into taking family photos, getting everyone gathered around at Christmas time for that one good shot. Those are nice. Over the years, maybe we're getting less formal. Do we see less of those kinds of shots? Are people taking fewer of those kinds of pictures and more of the kinds of pictures you're talking about that are more spontaneous?
Well, actually, I think maybe those are being replaced by selfies.
Ah.
You know, it seems like we see a lot more selfies now than anything.
Yeah, that's probably true. I hadn't thought of that. Good thing you're here then. let's take a call from Jim, who's joining us from Oconomowoc today. Jim, welcome to Central Time. Jim,
hello.
Are you with us? Yeah, Jim, go ahead.
Yes, I am. I'm 85 years old, and I'm doing kind of a memoir, and I'm finding photographs of my family and of the places in which they lived. And it has become so marvelous for me because they suddenly come to life, and I have all kinds of memories that have returned of my childhood.
That's a wonderful thing to have. When we have those photos, Deanna, that's a way for us to go back in time and relive some moments.
Oh, that's wonderful, Jim. And you know what? My dad went through all of the old family photos when he retired, and he wrote on the back of them who was in them and when they were taken or where they were taken, and what a great gift. So if you write on some of those photos, that'll be even better.
Jim, thanks so much for the call. You can join us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. What do pictures of your family mean to you? We used to be very adamant about creating family photo albums, and back, 10 years or so ago, maybe longer, 15, everybody was doing scrapbooking. I don't even know if that's still a thing, but we don't always print photos that much anymore. Should we consider making that a priority? I mean, we have them on our phones. Those are easy to lose. Should we be printing more photos?
Oh, yes, I think we should. And, you know, it's real easy to put them in a little book right now. I have a friend who makes a book for every year for his daughter and shows everything that went on in their family that year. And he sends it off to one of those little print by demand companies and ends up with a nice book on his shelf. And so if all those digital files get lost, he said at least he has a paper copy. And I think that's brilliant.
Great idea. Speaking of ideas, give us some pointers. How do we take a good shot? I mean, a lot of the shots that we will likely shots that we'll be likely to appreciate in the future, a lot of them don't necessarily feel special or inspiring when we may be first taking them. How do we figure out what's important to take a photo of?
Well, first of all, you have to look at the light and make sure there's some nice light coming on the subject matter. And then you'll have a good exposure, and you'll be able to see everything in there. And then, you know, hopefully you wait for that genuine moment, and maybe you have to take 5 or 6 to get one good picture, or maybe 8 or 10 or 20. You don't always get the right picture with one tap on the phone or one push of the button on the camera.
And technology gives us some easy ways to do that. I know, you know, you can hold your thumb down on the trigger and it just keeps shooting in bursts, or even shoot a short video and go back and do frame captures. Technology allows us to do a lot more than when we were simply working with Kodachrome, you know, the Brownie, and boy, I'm really dating myself now. I wasn't around when the daguerreotypes were popular, but you know, the technology has really given us a lot of tools that we can use, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and it can fill up our files with photos that we don't even know what to do with, too. So it's a little bit of a mixed blessing.
Well, we have to be willing to go through and cull some of them. Right now, we're about out of time. Deanna, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
That was Deanna Dykeman, artist and photographer based in Kansas City, Missouri. She's photographed family members for decades in her Relative Moments series, and her Leaving and Waving series featuring her parents was just featured in The New Yorker. We've got a link to that up at WPR.org/Central Time. The Safer at Home order issued by Governor Evers last week includes a long list of essential businesses and operations. Weddings and funerals were deemed essential, but the order restricts these gatherings to 10 people or fewer. As Bridget Bowden reports, people across Wisconsin are making adjustments to their plans.
Many people planning weddings look forward to bringing together family and friends all in one place to celebrate. But now that gatherings have been restricted to 10 people or fewer, many Wisconsin residents have had to put their plans on hold. Joanna Bundes lives in Madison and was planning a wedding party in May in her hometown, Toronto.
But now it's kind of tricky to cross the borders.
So they decided to delay the party until later this year and cancel an engagement party that was planned for April.
At first it was more stressful, but then we've been trying to keep it in perspective and making sure all our guests are healthy and feel comfortable attending.
Right now they're looking for a new date, but they're not exactly sure when travel will be safe again.
And that's, I guess, the hardest part, to go from a certain date that was coming and something to look forward to totally like unknown. We'll see what happens and taking it one day at a time.
County clerks can still issue marriage licenses, although some have moved online or made adjustments to the number of people they allow in their office at one time. But big wedding parties are out of the question right now, and that could be crushing for some small businesses. Like Bella Fiore Florist in Milwaukee, where President Emily Neubauer says she's already had to lay off staff members. They usually design the flowers for 150 weddings each year. With peak wedding season in limbo, so is the future of her business.
The June brides really feel like they're on eggshells because they don't know if they can go ahead with their June wedding or is this going to get extended.
And once the pandemic is over, she's not expecting business to bounce back immediately.
This is going to take time for people not to be scared anymore and to come out of their houses and to get back into their buying habits.
Neubauer's shop also does floral arrangements for funerals, which are now restricted to a maximum of 10 people as well. And people don't always have the ability to postpone a funeral. To give grieving families the opportunity to have a timely funeral, Cotter Funeral Home in De Pere has taken services online. They're offering Facebook Live streaming of visitation and funeral services. Co-owner Matt Cotter says it's been helpful for groups with more than 10 people and for family and friends who aren't able to travel right now.
It's difficult for them to have to go through this at this time and not have the support of their extended relatives, friends, other people that might normally come to a public visitation and funeral.
Cotter says he can stream funeral services from any location that has a cell signal or Wi-Fi. He can also make the videos part of a private group for people who don't want their loved ones' funerals public on the internet.
When somebody asks you for something, specifically when you're in a business like ours, you don't want to say no.
In some cases, though, having a public funeral just isn't an option right now. Carol Bartelt of West Bend recently lost her aunt, who was a nun in the Order of the Franciscan Sisters of Christian Charity in Manitowoc.
I just loved her. She was one of my very favorite people in the world.
She says her 98-year-old aunt, Sister Juliana, was given a small private burial at the convent. She hopes there can be a public funeral for family and friends at some point, but right now, she says she's really missing the chance to get together with family and remember her aunt.
We would like to see each other, and maybe even go to a mass together. And that, the churches are closed. So our connection is over the phone, and it's hard, it's just really hard now.
At the same time, Bartelt wants her family members to do what they can to protect their health. And for now, that means staying home. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, New York City helped launch Wisconsin's own Frank Lloyd Wright to fame. But the groundbreaking architect could not have cared less for the city. We'll learn a lot more when we talk to an architect and historian who investigated the relationship between Wright and New York. Frank Lloyd Wright, a colorful individual, to be sure. That coming up after the news on Central Time. I'm John Munson, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm John Munson, in for Rob Ferret. Some Whole Foods employees are holding a nationwide sick out today, demanding higher wages and more protections against COVID-19. It follows one-day strikes by Amazon and Instacart workers. Coming up, we look at issues facing workers on the front lines of the pandemic, their employers, and consumers. First, Frank Lloyd Wright is the quintessential American architect. He's best known for his works like Falling Water in Pennsylvania that were part of the prairie style, which favored clean lines and harmony with nature. Born in Richland Center in 1867, Wright's work is on display in several private dwellings throughout Wisconsin, and he founded his School of Design, Taliesin, in the Spring Green area. While his personal and design roots ran deep in the Badger State, his reputation as a star architect really took off in New York City. But while New York loved him, he wasn't its biggest fan, calling it everything from a prison to an incongruous man-trap. But despite his dislike, Wright was immensely influenced by New York and might not have had his terrific success without it. Anthony Olofsson holds the Roland Gammel-Rusner Centennial Professorship in Architecture at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also the author of Wright and New York, The Making of America's Architect. Anthony, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much, John.
Frank Lloyd Wright, as we think about him today in our popular imagination, very different from Frank Lloyd Wright the person. What was happening with Wright that brought him to New York?
Well, he had experience in New York from 1909 onward, but he began to spend more time in the critical mid-1920s, when his professional life and his personal life were really at nadir. So he goes to New York in the winter of 1925, really fleeing his estranged wife, and thus began a series of visits, increasing in time, that connected him to what was going on in the city at that time.
Frank Lloyd Wright had a colorful history in many ways. He was a subject of a lot of stories in tabloid-type newspapers during his lifetime. What was going on with him during the Jazz Age? You mentioned that he went to New York to get away from his estranged wife. What else was happening?
Well, his professional projects had been falling through one after another, and he'd basically been peripatetic from around 1922, when he returned from Japan, right up until he was able to move back more permanently to his home in Spring Green, Taliesin. So he was married to one woman, fell in love with another woman, got her pregnant. This was the woman who became his third wife, Olga Ivanovna. When the wife who he was connected to discovered this, all hell broke loose. All of the newspapers all over the country carried these exploits in a kind of mode of yellow journalism and Wright's press from mid-1920s could not have been worse. So this is what he was trying to recover from as he headed to New York with the hopes of safety, really, but also two projects that were important for the resurrection of his career.
So what were some of the other challenges Wright faced during his career?
Well, he was someone whose personality and biography is so large. And of course, he lived to be almost 92 years old. So this reputation, which he in some ways fostered and inflamed, stood in the way of his progress at times. He alienated some of the very people who were there to support him or to be the kind of clients one needs, particularly for large-scale projects. His ego was really compensatory. He's a guy who had a chip on his shoulder, and that makes for rough dealings with people. He was emulated and loathed at the same time. So he was dealing constantly with this combination of factors as he continually sought to revive his architectural practice. What's always amazing to me is that no matter how messed up his personal life was, the creative flow of his work was continuous and exciting.
Anthony Olofsson is a professor in architecture at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also the author of Wright and New York, The Making of America's Architect. So exactly how did New York help repair Wright's career?
Well, when he began to spend time there, one of his oldest and most important friends, a client who people know really nothing about, was a minister named William Norman Guthrie. Guthrie commissioned Wright for two extraordinary projects, and that began to give Wright hope that there was a way out of the problems he was dealing with. And because he was in New York, he came in touch with a circle of young designers and modernists who really promoted him. So the ball starts rolling with these projects, one for an amazing utopian cathedral, the other for an apartment building, with these connections in the literary world. So Wright became part of the discussion of what was happening in the city. At the same time, he began to publish numerous articles in Architectural Record, one of the leading professional journals of the time that was headquartered in New York. So a combination of a vibe promoting him, his writings, and his own publicity of the projects for Guthrie put him in a kind of public limelight. So suddenly, instead of being a pariah, he's asked to give lectures at Princeton University. He's feted by professionals in New York, including the grand old men of the architectural profession, the major figures who'd been producing extraordinary Art Deco buildings throughout the 1920s. So by 1930, his reputation is on the rise. Just when the Depression hits and is making many other architects retreat and fall back.
The relationship that that Wright had with New York seemed mutually beneficial, but what did the architect really think of the city?
Well, that was one of the most fascinating things about this research, because Wright was a guy who was loaded with bluster and rhetoric, and he began to use the city as a kind of whipping boy, as a kind of counterpoint to the ideas he was developing for an ideal way of living in the countryside called Broadacre City. Now, it's interesting to note, Wright is moving back and forth between Taliesin outside of Spring Green and New York, an easy thing to do by train from Chicago. So there's a kind of idealized picture of New York that he's painting with his rhetoric, while at the same time, he's enjoying it immensely. And by the end of his career, he so enjoyed New York that, of course, as we know, he took over a suite at the Plaza Hotel. This became Taliesin East. So the point I'm making is there's the bluster in the rhetoric, the I hate New York thing, but actually the reality that it's New York that's supporting him and turning him around, giving him opportunities that no one else did. Now, another thing to keep in mind for our listeners is there's a long tradition of people complaining about New York, from Herman Melville, who wrote Moby Dick, to poets, artists, and so forth throughout the 1920s. People who loved to complain about the city but were irretrievably drawn to it at the same time. And Wright always wanted to present himself as absolutely unique, but in a way, he was part of a big, long American tradition.
Well, what a fascinating personality Frank Lloyd Wright was, and we're happy that we had you with us today to tell us a little bit about it. Thank you so much, Anthony Olofsson, for being with us today. Anthony Olofsson is the Roland Gamet Reznor Centennial Professorship in Architecture at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also the author of Wright and New York, The Making of America's Architect. He joined us today to talk about the relationship between Frank Lloyd Wright and New York City. Coming up, we'll look at the issues behind worker strikes at Whole Foods, Amazon, and Instacart amid the coronavirus pandemic. You're listening to Central Time. I'm John Munson. Coming up, we'll talk to an author whose debut novel delves into Black queer identity on a Midwestern college campus based on his time at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Now, however, some workers at Whole Foods are holding a nationwide sick out today. Many of them are part-time or contract employees, so they don't have benefits like health insurance or paid sick leave. They're upset that they're on the front lines of the COVID-19 pandemic without adequate protections. Whole Foods recently increased hourly wages through April and awarded double pay for overtime through early May. It's also giving employees who are diagnosed with COVID-19 or quarantined additional paid time off, but workers say it's not enough. The strike comes after workers at Amazon and Instacart held a one-day walkout over similar concerns. Aaron Hatton is an associate professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Buffalo. She specializes in work and labor markets. She also got her master's and doctorate degrees from UW-Madison. Aaron, good to have you back.
Hi, John. Thanks so much for having me.
What kind of risks are these workers facing in doing their jobs?
Well, these workers are facing all sorts of risks. I mean, the most immediate risk is that they themselves could get exposed to the virus and be ill. They're kind of often clumped. Many of these workers are in close quarters in these large warehouses running at full speed ahead kind of all day long. And so the risk is not only that they themselves will be exposed, but then as a result, they will also expose other people, their coworkers, through this kind of close proximity, but also customers, because as we know, this virus can live on hard surfaces like plastic and metal. And it can live for several days. So there's a very real risk. And so they're in this kind of point of vulnerability, both for in terms of themselves and exposing other people.
How much sacrifice? Well, Whole Foods is owned by Amazon. A couple of weeks ago, both companies increased pay and benefits to their workers. What do those increases consist of?
I do think that they raise both. They increase benefits. They increase some hazard pay for some workers. They increase pay. But the reality of the matter is it hasn't been quite enough. I think there's suddenly we have new recognition that these workers are really on the front lines. They're on the front lines of our economy, trying to keep our economy afloat during this time of public crisis. And they're in this point of vulnerability in terms of this health crisis, right? They can be exposed and they can expose others. So they're asking for not just increased pay and benefits. So they do need more of that, not only for workers who have been officially diagnosed with COVID-19, but also workers whose doctors have told them to stay at home. But they're also asking for basic sanitation for their workplaces so that if one of their colleagues does come down sick, they're asking that the workplace should be closed and cleaned properly.
So how much of a sacrifice is Amazon making for these higher wages and increased benefits?
Amazon is an incredibly successful and profitable company. And whereas many businesses are having to shut down during this public health crisis, Amazon is largely doing quite well, right? They're serving lots and lots of people who cannot or don't want to or should not go out and shop. And so in a way, they're performing an important public service. But sure, increasing worker pay and increasing worker benefits, they're going to take a bit of a hit. I suspect that they will come through relatively unscathed with the increase in benefits and pay that they've committed to so far. And it is clear that given the importance of these workers, they need to commit to more.
Well, it seems like the workers' safety concerns ought to really come ahead of talk about increases in pay. That should be a separate issue. How has Amazon responded to worker calls about the worker safety issue? I mean, how can workers feel comfortable going to work if because of their own risk factors or for other reasons? And shouldn't they be able to stay at home if they feel unsafe?
I think that's absolutely the case. What we're hearing is workers are saying over and over again that they don't feel safe, that while the workplace has improved a little bit for them, there is not enough safety protections put in place for themselves and their coworkers and their customers to keep everyone, to kind of adhere to the social distancing guidelines that all of us are supposed to be adhering to this, during this time. And it's absolutely the case that Amazon as a company should be sure that they too are adhering to those guidelines for the sake of their workers and for the sake of their customers.
Instacart is an online grocery delivery service. The company said it would make hand sanitizer available to its workers upon request and outlined changes to its tip system. Is there anything else that Instacart could do?
Yes. Foremost, I mean, one thing that all of these workers really need is they need to have paid sick leave even when they don't have an official diagnosis for the coronavirus. Because what we've seen happening, we all know that there's been a severe lack of testing for this virus. It's an ongoing widespread issue. So that so many people are presumed to have it without having an official diagnosis. And even those people who have been tested, the results are taking weeks to come back. So that means that you have these workers in limbo. They're sick. They shouldn't go to work. Perhaps their doctor has officially told them to stay home, but because they don't have an official diagnosis, they do not qualify for paid sick leave. And so what are they to do? They're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. Either they lose their jobs, lose their incomes, or go to sick and risk exposing their coworkers and their customers.
Now, the guy who led the Amazon strike in New York said he was fired for his actions. New York's attorney general called the firing immoral and inhumane. Amazon said he violated safety regulations, including failing to abide by a required quarantine after being exposed to a coworker with COVID-19. What are your thoughts on this guy's dismissal?
Right. Well, certainly the timing is suspicious. I obviously was not there, and, you know, it will require an NLRB investigation to see what happened. But because firing workers for union activities or collective action activities is illegal, but it happens quite a bit, what usually happens is that employers have a different story about why that worker was fired. And then there's an investigation to resolve the issue to determine whether the firing was illegal. I will say certainly, given that he led a strike yesterday and was fired yesterday, the timing is remarkably suspicious, but I will leave it to the NLRB to investigate and find out what really happened.
And of course, when that is eventually resolved, and the story about the investigation will probably be on page 17. Aaron Hatton is an associate professor in the Department of Sociology at the University at Buffalo. We're talking about labor relations, Amazon, Whole Foods, Instacart, a lot of safety concerns here. As you mentioned, Aaron, the delivery industry has surged during the coronavirus outbreak. The companies like Amazon and Instacart are trying to hire hundreds of thousands of new workers. Do you see them having trouble hiring that many people, given the concerns, the safety concerns we've been talking about so far?
Well, unfortunately, perhaps not. And that's because so many people have lost their jobs. And they're really struggling. And even if they have a fever, like I said, they're stuck between a rock and a hard place. They need to feed their families. They're in an incredibly vulnerable position. And the, you know, very kind of weak social safety net, the small checks that we're sending out for most of these families, it just will not be enough. They need income to survive. And so I can certainly imagine plenty of workers looking to, say, Instacart or Amazon or Whole Foods to get work during this really difficult time.
Well, what about government regulators? Don't we still have OSHA? Shouldn't they be looking into safety concerns at places like Amazon and others?
Yes, absolutely. Government regulators in all forms, in terms of the obvious option would be OSHA in terms of workplace protection and safety. OSHA, however, has been notoriously underfunded for a long time now, so that there are very few inspectors going into workplaces. And certainly in this moment of crisis, the turnaround just hasn't been there. So there's very little monitoring of, and because this crisis is quite frankly unprecedented, at least in recent history, there's been a little awareness of what to do, how to react, and monitoring of workplaces and enforcement of standards for workplaces to adhere to basic social distancing guidelines.
Are these strikes having any impact on company operations?
Well, that's a good question. As of right now, the companies say no. They say business as usual, everything is fine. But, you know, I think the real story may come out later. And I do think that these workers are both at this kind of moment of increased vulnerability, but also increased power, because really they are laboring on the front lines of our service economy at this moment. They're keeping that economy going, but they can leverage that power to demand the basic workplace safety protections that they need.
What are you going to be watching for next when it comes to Amazon, Instacart, and Whole Foods and their workers?
Well, I'll be looking for more of these labor actions. These types of workers don't have a very strong history of such collective action. It's quite hard. There's a lot of turnover. There's a lot of these workers are often dispersed across many different workplaces. They're relatively low paid. It's difficult to organize and act. But like I said, because they have this kind of moment of power and this moment of recognition that they are really important workers, in fact, that I will be looking for more collective action around these issues from workers.
Okay. Erin, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Erin Hatton is an associate professor in the Department of Sociology at the University at Buffalo. We talked with her about worker strikes at Whole Foods, Amazon, and Instacart. Employees want greater protections. The COVID-19 pandemic means most of us are stuck in our homes, either working or just sitting around worrying about what comes next. But what if you found some productive things to do while you're self-isolating? How about doing a concert online? Why should John Legend have all the fun? All you need is a guitar or electronic keyboard and a webcam, right? I mean, I'm thinking of calling mine Songs I Don't Know Very Well. Or maybe you could write the great American novel, the one that's been bouncing around in your head since high school. And have you looked at your shower lately? Yeah, it might be time to give it a good scrub. What about those boxes you didn't get around to unpacking after your last move 20 years ago? Maybe time to let some of that stuff go. And finally, if people have been making fun of the way your home office looks during video conferences, how about getting rid of some of that clutter? A clean office is a happy office. Okay, maybe I'm projecting a bit there. Bottom line, we can make this downtime productive if we just use our imagination. Stay home and stay safe. Coming up next, the news from NPR and WPR. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.